to get the hour underway by welcoming in our friend, writer Colin Fleming. Hello, Colin.
Mr. Kimball, how are you today, sir?
I am doing all right here for a Tuesday. Weird weather. We've been, the sun's out, then it gets all cloudy. Looks like it's about to rain. It's tough to tell what to do out there. Now, if you're, I think I know the answer to this, if you're headed out for one of your epic walks, you really don't care what the weather is, do you?
You do care, because when it's bad weather, you feel like you've accomplished more. So you actually like it when it's raining and nobody's out, and you really feel like a Zulu warrior. But I did want to make sure I said to you today, because I saw your Facebook post about your mom being gone 50 years.
Yeah.
And so you were on my mind, and I just wanted to say that I would imagine she is, and always has been, very proud of the parent you are, and the spouse, and the teacher, and the friend, and the son. And those were some really great photos, I thought, that you put up.
Well, thanks. I appreciate that, my friend. Yeah, 50 years and in the blink of an eye there. Well, we got a lot of ground to cover here today. And first, I'm fascinated by this idea you have, and if there's anybody alive who could do it, it'd be you. The idea of writing an entire book, Carrie, you'll love this, based on the guitar solo in Pink Floyd's Time.
Actually, I think it's really easy, to be honest with you. Like, I just wrote, for instance, this whole Sam Cooke book about this one live album, and I did it in 15 days, as it were. And you find that when you write a book like that, and this is one of the ways that it was good for me, was that you see how easy it is to build off of something to make it into a lot more than what it ostensibly could be. Like, there's practically a whole chapter in the Sam Cooke book about them just warming up for the first number. And you think, like, oh, there can't be, like, a chapter about that. But it leads into all of these other things, this layering, if you're able to see things that way. So if you take something like this minute-and-a-half-long guitar solo, it starts, for instance, with this chord that's one of the most remarkable chords in the history of Western music. And so what that triggers is a discussion of similar chords, maybe in terms of their magnitude, their impact. And so you're going right away from the Beatles to Wagner and the Tristan chord to this chord that David Gilmour starts this solo with. So this is like one example right there where, yes, it's this chord. And you talk all about the details of the chord and how it's produced and everything. And the chord lasts, it has to sustain for all of 4 seconds. But you see how it takes you into all of those other different things. And you're looking at the guitar architecture that might have anticipated this defining guitar moment for Pink Floyd. So that takes you back to Syd Barrett and what he was doing on lead guitar before David Gilmour came in. And you're looking at unreleased recordings like the so-called Syd Barrett tapes. And you're considering what Gilmour brought to the band. And you're looking at how the solo functions in the song as a kind of story within a story. So then that takes you back to instrumental music, popular music of the 1950s and early 1960s, and the Ventures and the influence on surf music of Pink Floyd. And what does the solo do? It builds and builds and builds. It's not unlike a Powell and Pressburger film, Stairway to Heaven. So now you're talking about the British cinematic tradition. You're talking about British folk music, because that's what really this solo is kind of cleaved from, which you wouldn't expect. And then you're talking Nick Drake. You're talking the pastoral. You're going back to Shakespeare with the lyric. You're going back to this 1972 residency at the Rainbow Theater, where the solo was worked out on stage before they even got into the studio for Dark Side of the Moon. So you can see, really, when you get into it, damn easy.
What I love about that is traditionally, in any kind of piece like that, you would start big picture and work your way in to focus on this one particular thing. And you've just completely flipped that to use that. That guitar solo as a jumping off point for, in many ways, the history of music.
Yes, exactly. And that's really a lot of what I do. It's a simplistic way of saying it, but we've talked about things like that short story, First Responder. And what is the story really about? The bombs go off during the tragedy of the marathon, and this kid finds something on the ground that he puts in his pocket because he thinks it's body part, something invaluable to somebody's survival, and is going to try and get to the hospital. And we find out at the end what this is. It grows and blows up into this much bigger thing than a kid picking something off the ground. And it's really sort of the spirit of the longer on the inside stories. And so it's about perception. It's about being able to recognize that an exchange between two people that might be 13 words long can contain universes. And art's the same way. And music's the same way. And if you understand, it's really just about seeing. Seeing properly will dictate a lot of what's going to happen for you. And then it's just musical knowledge. And plus, with me, like, for instance, in the Sam Cooke book, this will sound crazy, but a key component of this Sam Cooke book is Nevin Marquardt, who was a, like, fourth-line forward for the Boston Bruins in the 1980s. You think, like, what could Marquardt have anything to do with Sam Cooke in Miami in 1963? Turns out a lot, but a lot of people wouldn't have both of those things at their disposal. Then you're just getting into cool stuff about the music. Like, for instance, this solo is, as I said, a minute and a half long. It's built out of so few notes. It's built out of fewer notes than you would think a solo that long could be built out of, because it's built out of some of the longest lasting notes in all of popular music. Then you talk about, like, the guitar, the effects in the studio, all of this, the writing component of the solo. And like I said, it becomes this giant, cool thing that's not niche. Like, this is not a niche story. It sounds maybe at first like, oh, that's for, like, the same person who wants to read about the company that made Ringo Starr's drums, but it's not. It's like you said, it's kind of like a history of Western popular music in a way via this one guitar solo.
Colin Fleming with us here on Downtown. I had forgotten about this until you brought it up the other day. The fact that back in 86 and 87, the Red Sox and Mets played a couple of charity exhibition games, and the first one ended up, of course, being a preview of the World Series.
So strange to think about now, easy, like you said, to forget about. And these two games for the Jimmy Fund were agreed to in 1985. So the Mets, like, in 85 were good. They were on the cusp. They were exciting. The Red Sox were like, do you like Tony Armas? Like, they were really not that scintillating. They weren't horrible. So the way it slotted out the next year, near the end of the season, no less. So imagine that. Like, you're near the end of the season. You have these two teams that could meet in the World Series, because it was starting to look that way. It had looked that way for a while that year. And then in early September, the Mets come to Fenway to play the Red Sox. Just like as if 162 real games weren't enough, there is this thing as well. And then the next year, in 1987, this is like some personal history, because I was at this game, young me, with my dad. We had just moved to Connecticut, and one of my last memories of when we lived in Mansfield, Massachusetts, was the Red Sox not winning the World Series. In Game 6, it was late, and I remember I was walking upstairs, because I didn't need to see them celebrate. I knew that they were going to win, and then my dad's like, oh, no! Oh, dear! Jesus H. Christ! Like, back down the stairs, because Jesus H. Christ, if my dad was rolling that out, things were not trending well. And then I watched that, and I didn't talk to him. He didn't want to say anything to him. So we're at this game in May of 1987 at Shea Stadium, and we're in the bleachers. And I didn't know, I think bleachers back then were probably different than bleachers right now. I didn't know about this entire ecosystem, Mr. Kimball, of these ne'er-do-wells. It's a really nice way of calling these people. And it was so strange. It was like being at this crime scene after the fact. Like, here are the Red Sox, and they kind of sucked in 87. And so you're just back at Shea Stadium for the first time since they lost. And it was, I just remember thinking, like, this is weird and dreary. And David Cohn was on the mound. Got to see him. And to boot, the Red Sox got shut out.
And of course, this was at a time when the only interleague baseball that took place was All-Star Game and World Series.
Yes, it was very odd. It was almost like a 1930s barnstorming team, when, like, Lou Gehrig and Babe Ruth would get together and be like the Rube and Lou's, right? They had those funny names. Except this was just, I didn't understand it. I didn't really know why we were there, because, as you said, interleague play was so foreign. Like, it was shocking. Remember when you'd watch the All-Star game
mm-hmm.
and Roger Clemens would come up to hit? Like, it was just, it was bizarre. He's thinking like, oh, he handles the bat as well. So there was that, like, novelty on top of a novelty on top of a novelty on top of, like, depression. And it just was so strange. And actually, the first game from Fenway is on YouTube in its entirety. Wow. I cannot find the one that I went to in 1987, but there were these guys. I just, pure animalism out in those Shea Stadium bleachers.
Let's talk about a movie from 60 years ago, The Hustler. And great performance by Paul Newman. I always felt like the Academy Award that he got for The Color of Money many years later was, in many ways, a payback for not winning it for his role in The Hustler.
That's interesting, because I watched this film again over the weekend, and I thought the opposite. I thought he was laughably bad. I thought everybody in this film was laughably bad, except for Jackie Gleason. I thought it was like method acting and overacting run amok. Like, I am going to show you my acting chops. Behold, it was histrionic to me, with the exception, like I said, of Gleason. Now, I know that's not how the film is regarded. It's regarded more along the lines of what you just said, with everyone affirming it as a classic laden with great performances. But to me, it just has not aged well from the thespian standpoint.
Not even Piper Laurie. I thought she was great.
No, I thought she was silly. I found it very hard to take her seriously with the caterwauling and the ripping out of hair and all but rending of garments. And I just didn't find it believable at all. And then I thought, like, the Jackie Gleason character as Minnesota Fats, it was just such a great role, but he's so, I didn't like how it was written. It's just such a passive role, and it can be passive for long stretches, certainly at the beginning, because he's really in, like, the first part of the film is built around that exchange where they play for 40 straight hours and drinking the whiskey and everything. And then at the end, it's a long film, but that end, when he comes back, when Paul Newman's character comes back and they have sort of the rematch, it's rushed. Like, you're looking at how much time is left in the film. And there's like 12 minutes left. And you're thinking, they're going to be able to get this in. But I thought it would have been such a more compelling character if he wasn't, Jack Gleason, that is, if he wasn't passive the entire way through, because he has this ability at the end to intervene and to say something. And even if, like, what he says doesn't influence the outcome, it would be, like, still a statement. But there's nothing like that. You kind of lose respect for the Gleason character when he just goes along at the end with the villainy, when he says, you better just pay the man. It's like, oh, come on. At least, like, say something. They'll take you seriously. They'll value your voice. So I just thought it was very overwrought and ham-fisted, to be honest with you.
Now, I like it, but I will say, if I'm going to watch a pool-related show, I would rather watch the 30-minute, 22-minute Twilight Zone, a game of pool with Jack Klugman and Jonathan Winters.
They're so similar. And, like, one who hasn't seen the show and the film The Hustler in a while could easily conflate the two, don't you think?
I do.
Because it's like a Minnesota Fats redux. It's like I don't want to say a poor man's Jackie Gleason, but obviously there's something. Klugman, to me, is, and he was so good, and I think he's maybe the most consistent of the Twilight Zone actors, for ones that had, he was in what, four episodes?
I believe so, yeah. I would put him up there with, I guess, Burgess Meredith, and maybe even better.
I can't stand Burgess Meredith in the Twilight Zone. Like, I won't even watch Burgess Meredith. They're so talky to me. They're so overridden, and that milquetoast character, and they hinge on the, I don't like the twist ending ones. They're just not, they don't have the same, they're kind of one and done for me. They don't have the same value. And the Burgess Meredith episodes tended to be these in-your-face intellectualism episodes. And I don't think the Twilight Zone had a need to do that. The Twilight Zone came across as a lot smarter and more intellectual, ironically, when it kept that overt nature of cerebralness under wraps, when it did more of the showing than the telling. I think that's really where, like, Rod Serling's best writing came together. We've talked about some of those episodes. But, yeah, I think Klugman, that's a compact condensation of this idea. And I think that's a great one, the Twilight Zone, because the Minnesota Fats type of guy is like, you don't want this responsibility. So it's like he's passive in a way, but he's also not passive because he's
right
playing this role in shaping the narrative. And Jackie Gleason really does. He's like a stud at the barn, just doing his thing. And he doesn't really have any more utility than that.
We're talking with Colin Fleming here on Downtown. Let's talk about statistics, the backbone of the world of sports in many ways. But you can make a pretty good case that many of the statistics that we have looked up to for years and years don't have the same value anymore.
A lot has changed. I was thinking about that because, well, just to take it back to the 1986-87 Red Sox, like Bill Buckner for a while was seen, do you remember this, as kind of a fringe Hall of Fame guy because
right.
he had upwards of 2,700 hits and he won a batting title. But his WAR, which everybody uses right now, was like Dave Kingman low. I actually like Dave Kingman. I thought you got more bang for your buck with Kingman. But Buckner's WAR was like 15. But Buckner's goal every year was not to have an on-base percentage or walk or get on-base or anything. He wanted to get singles. And he wanted to hit 300. I think he hit like 285 for his career. And you see now that the 300 average in baseball, it means absolutely nothing. It's almost like a negative, like you failed in some way. So I just was thinking about all of these statistics that really have no meaning, and not just the statistics, but things that have become obsolete in the sports over the years. But remember when, like, a triple-double, for instance, in basketball was a big deal? Now it's kind of meaningless. Like, they're so common. It was this big thing when one guy averaged a triple-double for a whole season. Now it's like people are on the cusp of it. Someone did it a few years ago. And the three-pointer used to be like, oh, wow, he shot from far away. Now if you watch a modern NBA game, it's a three-pointer like 75% of the time down the court.
Right.
The same thing every time. So those were two. But you can find them in all of the sports.
And you mentioned no-hitters. We've already seen two this season, and I think that last one was the 308th no-hitter in the history of Major League Baseball. And you know, if you look at that list of guys who've thrown no-hitters in the big leagues, you won't recognize half the games because so many of them were thrown by journeymen.
I don't understand people's interest in no-hitters. It is, to my thinking, the ultimate empty novelty achievement. Like, it really means nothing. It doesn't even mean that you pitched well, necessarily. I find now an actual complete game or a shutout every bit as interesting as a no-hitter. Maybe more so, because you managed to stay in despite giving up the hit. Now you're kept in the game because the manager doesn't want to be ripped apart later in the press and the guy's only here once in his lifetime. So to me, it's actually a harder statistical feat to throw a complete game shutout while giving up three hits than it is to throw a no-hitter. And it's just crazy because these whole, talk about the devaluation of, it used to be the most important positions in sports were the quarterback in the NFL, the goalie in the NHL, and the starting pitcher in baseball. And the only one that remains on that list is the quarterback. Get rid of the other two. In fact, I'm going to write an op-ed about this. I think the second most important position in all of sports right now is the 1A defenseman in hockey, the Charlie McAvoy type player. You influence more of the game than anybody in any sport in North America, save the quarterback. But the no-hitter is meaningless. It's just like most of the things of that nature. I'm talking about hockey. Like, think when you watch the Bruins game tonight, for instance. There are no drop passes anymore. They're almost non-existent. Like, it's shocking when you see a drop pass, unless you count that big kind of looping breakout on the power play where the offensive team throws it back to the guy, the trailer, near the neutral zone, but like the top of his own end. So just like things like that could change. And think about like how in the NFL, 1,000 yards receiving was a big deal. 3,000 yards passing was a big deal. Now, you're pretty terrible if you don't complete 62% of your passes.
Well, yes. And you talk about that quarterback percentage is the one that I was thinking of, because you go back to guys like Namath, who was never really a great quarterback anyway, but he was
50%.
Right. He's a 50% quarterback. I don't think Unitas top 60% very often along the way, but they also weren't playing the West Coast game, and they weren't dropping off 20 passes a game of 3 to 7 yards.
Montana was over 60% for his career, and that can be confusing to people. He'd be like, he wasn't that good. But at the time, that was insane. Like, he was just as accurate. He was as high percentage as you got in the league for a long stretch. In fact, that was his greatness as such. Mm. It wasn't the downfield ball. It wasn't like having the John Elway rocket arm. And now I think this is going to be further messed up by, I don't understand, I mean, I understand financially, but the whole notion of a 17th game. So it's like the right. NFL, like, you kind of know what stats mean now. And they're just all going to be knocked out of, like, the 1,000-yard thing. Tony Michel, maybe gets 1,000 yards. What is that? It's like 65 yards a game. It's not that much, but it still means something. Now, it means nothing. It's like a worse version of when the NHL said, we shall have 84 games, like in 92, 93. So guys are getting 50 goals who just would have fallen below that mark before. Then it was like, everybody shall have 50 goals. That's like this really warped sort of statistical oddity period. So I don't know. I mean, one of the great things about baseball is if you go and look at stats from 1887, somebody leads the league with 131 runs scored. Somebody leads the league this year with 131 runs scored. Now, I know baseball has all of these problems where it's anchored in the past, but that's a consistency that I think is appealing to people. And so I think the NFL is going to, not like it's really a numbers thing that way, but it kind of is. It's going to lose that.
I think you're right. Absolutely. Colin Fleming with us on Downtown. Colin, appreciate it as always, my friend. We'll check in with you again next Tuesday afternoon.
Okay, sounds good.
By the way, check out Colin's website, colinflemminglit.com, and subscribe to the Many Moments More blog.